and it would be hot and damp. And down there, under the trees, would be snakes, insects, and the other creatures for whom this most inhospitable of places was indeed home. And they were welcome to it, John told them without words, out the door of the Nighthawk.
How are we doing, Malloy? John asked over the intercom.
Should have it in sight any second. There. See the lights dead ahead.
Got it.
Clark waved for the troops in the back to get ready.
Proceed as planned, Colonel Malloy.
Roger that, Six. He held course and speed, on a heading of 296, 700 feet AGL, above ground level, and a speed of 120 knots. The lights in the distance seemed hugely out of place, but lights they were, just where the navigation system and the satellite photos said they would be. Soon the point source broke up into separate, distinct sources.
Okay, Gearing, Clark was saying in the back. We're letting you go back to talk to your boss.
Oh? The prisoner asked through the black cloth bag over his head.
Yes, John confirmed.
You're delivering a message. If he surrenders to us, nobody gets hurt. If he doesn't, things'll get nasty. His only option is unconditional surrender. Do you understand that?
Yeah.
The head nodded inside the black bag. The Nighthawk's nose came up just as it approached the west end of the runway that some construction crew had carved into the jungle. Malloy made a fast landing without allowing his wheels to touch the ground. Standard procedure, lest there be mines there. Gearing was pushed out the door, and immediately the helicopter lifted back off, reversing course to the runway's east end. Gearing pulled the bag from his head and oriented himself, spotted the lights for Project Alternate, a facility he knew about but had never visited, and headed there without looking back. At the east end, the Nighthawk again came in to hover a foot or so off the ground. The rainbow troops leaped out, and the helicopter immediately climbed up for the return trip to Manaus, which would be made into the rising sun. Malloy and Harrison put on their sunglasses and held course, keeping a close watch on their fuel state. The 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment maintained its helos pretty well, the Marine thought, flexing his gloved hands on the controls. Just like the Air Force pukes in England. Noonan was the first to get set up. All the troops ran immediately into the thick cover a scant 100 yards from the thick concrete pavement of the runway and headed west, wondering if Gearing had noted their separate arrival here. It took fully half an hour for them to make their way over a distance that, had they run it, would have taken scarcely 10 minutes. For all that, Clark thought it was good time. And now he remembered the creepy feeling that came from being in the jungle, where the very air seemed alive with things hoping to suck one's blood and give you whatever diseases would take your life as slowly and painfully as possible. How the hell had he endured the 19 months he'd spent in Vietnam? 10 minutes here, and he was ready to leave. Around him, massive hardwood trees reached 200 or 300 feet to the sky, to form the top canopy of this fetid place, with secondary trees reaching about a third that height, and yet another that stopped at 50 or so, with bushes and other plants at his feet. He could hear the sound of movement, whether his own people or animals he couldn't be sure, though he knew that this environment supported all manner of life, most of it unfriendly to humans. His people spread out to the north, most of them plucking branches to tuck under the elastic bands that ran around their Kevlar helmets, the better to break up the outline of their unnatural shapes and improve their concealment. The front door of the building was unlocked, Gearing found, amazed that this should be so. He walked into what appeared to be a residential building, entered an elevator, punched the topmost button, and arrived on the fourth floor. Once there, it was just a matter of opening one of the double doors on the corridor
and flipping on a light in what had to be the master suite. The bedroom doors were open, and he walked that way. John Breitling's eyes reported the sudden blaze of light from the sitting room. He opened them and saw,
"What the hell are you doing here, Will?"
"They brought me down, John."
"Who brought you down?"
"The people who captured me in Sydney," Gearing explained.
"What?"
It was a little much for so early in the morning. Breitling stood and put on the robe next to the bed.
"John, what is it?"
Carol asked from her side of the bed.
"Nothing, honey, just relax."
John went to the sitting room, pulling the doors closed as he did so.
"What the fuck is going on, Will?"
"They're here, John."
"Who's here?"
"The counter-terror people, the ones who went to Australia, the ones who arrested me. They're here, John," Gearing told him, looking around the room, thoroughly disoriented by all the traveling he'd done, and not sure of much of anything at the moment.
"Here? Where, in the building?"
"No," Gearing shook his head. "They dropped me off by helicopter. Their boss is a guy named Clark. He said to tell you that you have to surrender.
Unconditional surrender, John."
"Or else what?" Breitling demanded.
"Or else they're going to come in and get us."
"Really?"
This was no way to be awakened. Breitling had spent $200 million to build this place. Labor costs were low in Brazil. And he considered Project Alternate a fortress, and more than that, a fortress that would have taken months to locate. Armed men, here, right now, demanding his surrender? What was this? Okay, he thought. First he called Bill Henriksen's room and told him to come upstairs. Next he lit up his computer. There was no email telling him that anyone had spoken with his flight crews. So nobody had told anyone where they were. So how the hell had anyone found out? And who the hell was here? And what the hell did they want? Sending someone he knew in to demand their surrender seemed like something from a movie.
"What is it, John?" Henriksen asked.
Then he looked at the other man in the room.
"Will, how did you get here?"
Breitling held up his hand for silence, trying to think while Gearing and Henriksen exchanged information. He switched off the room lights, looked out the large windows for signs of activity, and saw nothing at all.
"How many?" Bill was asking.
10 or 15 soldiers," Gearing replied.
"Are you going to do what they...
Are you going to surrender to them?" the former colonel asked.
"Hell no!" John Breitling snarled. "Bill, what they're doing, is it legal?"
"No, not really. I don't think it is, anyway."
"Okay, let's get our people up and armed."
"Right," the security chief said dubiously. He left the room for the main lobby, whose desk controlled the public address system in the complex.
"Oh, baby, talk to me," Noonan said.
The newest version of the DKL people-finding system was up and running now. He'd spotted two of the receiver units about 300 yards apart. Each had a transmitter that reported to a receiving unit that was in turn wired to his laptop computer.
The DKL system tracked the electromagnetic field generated by the beating of the human heart. This was, it had been discovered, a unique signal. The initial items sold by the company had merely indicated the direction of the signals they received. But the new ones had been improved with parabolic antennas to increase their effective range now to 1,500 meters, and by triangulation to give fairly exact positions, accurate to from 2 to 4 meters. Clark was looking down at the computer screen. It showed blips indicating people evenly spaced in their rooms in the headquarters residential building.
"Boy, this would have been useful in I-Corps back when I was a kid," John breathed.
Each of the Rainbow Troopers had a GPS locator built into his personal radio transceiver, and these also reported to the computer, giving Noonan and Clark exact locations for their own people, and locations also on those in the building to their left.
Yeah, that's why I got excited about this puppy, the FBI agent noted. I can't tell you what floor they're on, but look, they've all started moving. I guess somebody woke them up.
Command, this is Bear, Clark's radio crackled.
Bear, command, where are you?
5 minutes out. Where do you want me to make my delivery?
Same place as before.
Let's keep you out of the line of fire. Tell Vega and the rest that we are on the north side of the runway. My command post is 100 meters north of the tree line. We'll talk them in from there.
Roger that, command. Bear out.
This must be an elevator, Noonan said, pointing at the screen.
6 blips converged on a single point, stayed together for half a minute or so, then diverged. A number of blips were gathering in one place, probably a lobby of some sort. Then they started moving north and converged again.
I like this one, Dave Dawson said, hefting his G3 rifle. The black German-made weapon had fine balance and excellent sights. He'd been the site security chief in Kansas, another true believer who didn't relish the idea of flying back to America in federal custody and spending the rest of his life at Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary, a part of Kansas for which he had little love.
What do we do now, Bill?
Okay, we split into pairs. Everybody gets one of these. Henriksen started passing over handheld radios.
Think. Don't shoot until we tell you to. Use your heads.
Okay, Bill, I'll show these bastards what a hunter can do, Kilgore observed, liking the feel of his rifle as well and pairing off with Kirk McLean.
These two.
Henriksen opened another door, revealing camouflage jackets and pants for them to wear.
What can we do to protect ourselves, Bill? Steve Berg asked.
We can kill the fuckers, Kilgore replied. They're not cops. They're not here to arrest us, are they, Bill?
Well, no, and they haven't identified themselves. And so the law is unclear on this one, guys.
And we're in a foreign country anyway. So those guys are probably breaking the fucking law to be here, and if people want to attack us with guns, we can defend ourselves, right? Ben Farmer asked.
You know what you're doing? Berg asked Farmer.
Ex-Marine, baby. Light weapons. Line grunt. Yeah, I know what's happening out there.
Farmer looked confident, and was as angry as the rest of them at the upset of their plans.
Okay, people, I am in command, okay? Henriksen said to them. He had 30 armed men now. That would have to be enough.
We make them come to us. If you see somebody advancing toward you with a weapon, you take the bastard out. But be patient. Let them in close. Don't waste ammo. Let's see if we can discourage them. They can't stay here long without supplies, and they only have one helicopter to...
Look, McLean said.
A mile and a half away, the black helo landed at the far end of the runway. 3 or 4 people ran from it into the woods.
Okay, be careful, people, and think before you act.
Let's do it, Kilgore said aggressively, waving to McLean to follow him out the door.
They're leaving the building, Noonan said. Looks like 30 or so. He looked up to orient himself on the terrain.
They're heading into the woods.
Figuring to ambush us, maybe?
We'll see about that.
Team 2, this is Command, Clark said into his tactical radio.
2 lead here, Command, Chavez replied.
I can see people running out of the building. They appear to be armed with shoulder weapons.
Roger that. Okay, Ding, we will proceed as briefed.
Understood, Command. Let me get organized here.
Team 2 was intact, except for the absence of Julio Vega, who'd just arrived on the second helicopter delivery. Chavez got onto his radio and paired his people off with their normal partners, extending his line northward into the forest, and keeping himself at the hinge point on the southern end of the line. The Team 1 people would be the operational reserve, assigned directly to John Clark at the command post.
Noonan watched the Team 2 shooters move. Each friendly blip was identified by a letter, so that he'd know them by name.
John, he asked,
When do we go weapons-free?
Patience, Tim, Six replied.
Noonan was kneeling on the damp ground, with his laptop computer sitting on a fallen tree. The battery was supposed to be good for 5 hours, and he had 2 spares in his pack. Pierce and Loisel took the lead, heading 0.5 kilometer into the jungle. It wasn't a first for either of them. Mike Pierce had worked in Peru 2 times, and Loisel had been to Africa 3 separate times. The familiarity with the environmental conditions was not the same thing as comfort. Both worried about snakes as much as the armed people heading their way, sure that this forest was replete with them, either poisonous or willing to eat them whole. The temperature was rising, and both soldiers were sweating under their camo makeup. After 10 minutes, they found a nice spot, with a standing tree and a fallen one next to it, with a decent field of fire.
"They've got radios," Noonan reported. "Want me to take them away?" He had his jammer set up already.
Clark shook his head.
"Not yet. Let's listen into them for a while."
"Fair enough."
The FBI agent flipped the radio scanner to the speaker setting.
"This is some place," one voice said. "Look at these trees, man."
"Yeah, big, ain't they?"
"What kind of trees?" a third asked.
"The kind somebody can hide behind and shoot your ass from," a more serious voice pointed out. "Kilgore and McLean keep moving north about 0.5 mile. Find a place and sit still there."
Yeah, okay, Bill," the third voice agreed.
"Listen up, everybody," Bill's voice told them. "Don't clutter up these radios, okay? Report in when I call you, or when you see something important. Otherwise, keep them clear."
"Yeah, okay. You say so, Bill. Roger."
"I can't see shit," a fifth responded.
"Then find a place where you can," another helpful voice suggested.
"They're in pairs, moving close together, most of them," Noonan said, staring down at his screen.
"This pair is heading right for Mike and Louie."
Clark looked down at the screen.
"Pierce and Loisel, this is command. You have 2 targets approaching you from the south, distance about 250 meters.
"Roger, command. Pierce copies."
Sergeant Pierce settled into his spot, looking south, letting his eyes sweep back and forth through a 90-degree arc. 6 feet away, Loisel did the same, starting to relax as far as the environment was concerned and tensing with the approach of enemies. Dr. John Kilgore knew the woods and knew hunting. He moved slowly and carefully now, with every step looking down to assure quiet footing, then up and around to examine the landscape for a human shape. They'd be coming in to get us, he thought, and so he and McLean would find good spots to shoot them from. Just like hunting deer, picking a place in the shadows where you could belly up and wait for the game to come. Another couple of 100 yards, he thought, would be about right. 300 meters away, Clark used the computer screen and the radios to get his people moving to good spots. This new capability was incredible. Like radar, he could spot people long before he or anyone else could see or hear them. This new electronic toy would be an astounding blessing to every soldier who ever made use of it.
"Here we go," Noonan said quietly, like a commentator at a golf tournament, tapping the screen.
"Pierce and Loisel, this is command. You have 2 approaching targets just east of south, approaching at about 200 meters.
"Roger, command."
"Can we engage?" Pierce asked.
At his perch, Loisel was looking at him instead of his direct front.
"Affirmative," Clark replied.
Then,
"Rainbow, this is Six. Weapons free. I repeat, we are weapons free at this time."
"Roger that. I copy weapons free," Pierce acknowledged.
"Let's wait till we can get both of them, Louie," Pierce whispered.
"D'accord," Sergeant Loisel agreed.
Both men looked to their south, eyes sharp and ears listening for the first snapped twig. This wasn't so bad, Kilgore thought. He'd hunted in worse country, far noisier country. There were no pine needles here to make that annoying swishing sound that deer could hear from half a time zone away. Plenty of shadows, little in the way of direct sunlight. Except for the bugs, he might have even been comfortable here. But the bugs were murder. The next time he came out, he'd try to spray some repellent, the physician thought, as he moved forward slowly. The branch of a bush was in his way. He used his left hand to move it, lest he make noise by walking through it. There, Pierce saw. A bush branch had just moved, and there wasn't a breath of wind down there to make that happen.
"Louis,"
he whispered. When the Frenchman turned, Pierce held up one finger and pointed. Loisel nodded and returned to looking forward. "I have a visual target," Pierce reported over his radio. "One target, 150 meters to my south." McLean was less comfortable on his feet than he would have been on horseback. He did his best to mimic the way John Kilgore was moving, however, though both keeping quiet and keeping up were proving to be incompatible. He tripped over an exposed root and fell, making noise, then swearing quietly before he stood.
"Bonjour," Loisel whispered to himself. It was as though the noise had switched on a light of sorts.
In any case, Sergeant Loisel now saw a man-shape moving in the shadows, about 150 meters away.
"Mike," he whispered, pointing to where his target was.
"Okay, Louis," Pierce responded. "Let them get closer, man."
"Yes."
Both men shouldered their MP-10s, though the range was a little too far as yet. If there was anything larger than an insect moving, Kilgore thought, he couldn't hear it. There were supposed to be jaguars in this jungle, leopard-sized hunting cats whose pelts would make a nice throw rug, he thought. And the 7.62-millimeter NATO round this rifle fired should be more than adequate for that purpose. Probably night hunters, though, and hard to stalk. But what about the capybaras, the largest rat in the world, supposed to be good to eat despite its biological family? They were supposed to feed during the day, weren't they? There was so much for his eyes to see here, so much visual clutter, and his eyes weren't used to it yet. Okay, he'd find a place to sit still, so that his eyes could learn a pattern of light and darkness, and then note the change in it that denoted something that didn't belong. There's a good spot, he thought. A fallen tree and a standing one.
"Come on in, sweetheart," Pierce whispered to himself.
At 100 yards, he thought, that would be close enough. He'd have to hold a little high, like for the target's chin, and the natural drop of the bullet would place the rounds in the upper chest. A headshot would be nicer, but the distance was a little too far for that, and he wanted to be careful. Kilgore whistled and waved to McLean, pointing forward. Kirk nodded agreement. His initial enthusiasm for this job was fading rapidly. The jungle wasn't quite what he expected, and being out here with people trying to attack him didn't make the surroundings any more attractive. He found himself, strangely, thinking of that singles bar in New York, the darkened room and loud dance music. Such a strange environment. And the women he'd found there. It was too bad, really, what had happened to them. They were, had been, people, after all. But worst of all, their deaths had not had any meaning. At least, had the project moved forward, their sacrifice would have counted for something, but now it was just a failure. And here he was in the fucking jungle, holding a loaded rifle,
looking for people who wanted to do to him what he'd done.
Louis, you got your target?
Yes.
Okay, let's do it, Pierce called in a raspy voice. And with that he tightened his grip on the MP-10, centered the target on the sights, and squeezed the trigger gently. The immediate result was the gentle puff-puff-puff sound of the three shots, the somewhat louder metallic sound of the cycling of the submachine gun's action, and then the impact of all three rounds on the target. He saw the man's mouth spring open, and then the figure fell. His ears reported similar sounds from his left. Pierce left his spot and ran forward, his weapon up, with Loisel in close support. Kilgore's mind didn't have time to analyze what had happened to him, just the impacts to his chest. And now he was looking straight up into the treetops, where there were small cracks of blue and white from the distant sky. He tried to say something, but he wasn't breathing very well at the moment, and when he turned his head a few inches, there was no one there to see. Where was Kirk, he wondered, but found himself unable to move his body to... He'd been shot? The pain was real but strangely distant, and he lowered his head to see blood on his chest and... Who was that in camouflage clothing, his face painted green and brown? And who are you, Sergeant? Pierce wondered. His three rounds had sprinkled across the chest, missing the heart but ripping into the upper lungs and major blood vessels. The eyes were still looking, focused on him. Wrong playground, partner, he said softly. And then life left the eyes, and he bent down to collect the man's rifle. It was a nice one, Pierce saw, slinging it across his back. Then he looked left to see Loisel holding an identical rifle in one hand and waving his hand across his throat. His target was bloodily dead, too.
"Hey, you can even tell when they get killed," Noonan said.
When the heart stopped, so did the signals the DKL gadget tracked.
Cool, Timothy thought.
"Pierce and Loisel, this is Command. We copy you took down two targets."
"That's affirmative," Pierce answered. "Anything else close to us?"
"Pierce," Noonan replied, "two more about 200 meters south of your current position. This pair is still moving eastward slowly. They're heading toward McTyler and Patterson."
"Pierce, this is Command. Sit tight," Clark ordered.
"Roger, Command."
Next, Pierce picked up the radio his target had been carrying, leaving it on. With nothing else to do, he fished into the man's pants. So, he saw a minute later, he had just killed John Kilgore, M.D., of Binghamton, New York.
"Who were you?" he wanted to ask the body.
But this Kilgore fellow would answer no more questions. And who was to say that the answers would have made any sense?
"Okay, people, everybody check in," the citizens' band walkie-talkie said over Noonan's scanner unit.
Henriksen was just inside the tree line, hoping that his people had the brains to sit still once they found good spots. He worried about the incoming soldiers, if that's what they were. The project people were a little too eager and a little too dumb. His radio crackled with voices acknowledging his order, except for two. "Kilgore and McLean, report in." Nothing. "John, Kirk, where the hell are you?"
"That's the pair we took out," Pierce called into command. "Want me to let him know?"
"Negative, Pierce. You know better than that," Clark replied angrily.
"No sense of humor, our chief," Loisel observed to his partner, with a Gallic shrug.
"Who's closest to them?" the voice on the radio asked next.
"Me and Dawson," another voice answered.
"Okay, Berg and Dawson, move north. Take your time and see what you can see, okay?"
"Okay, Bill," yet another voice said.
"More business coming our way, Louis," Pierce said.
"Oui," Loisel agreed. He pointed.
that tree, Mike.
It had to be 3 meters across at the base, Pierce saw. You could build a house from the lumber from just that one. A big house, too.
Pierce and Loisel, command. 2 targets just started moving towards you, almost due south. They're close together.
Dave Dawson was a man trained in the United States Army 15 years before, and he knew enough to be worried. He told Berg to stay close behind him, and the scientist did, as Dawson led the way.
Command, Patterson, I have movement to my direct front about 200 meters out.
That's about right, Noonan said. They're heading straight for Mike and Louie.
Patterson, command, let him go.
Roger,
Hank Patterson acknowledged.
This isn't very fair, Noonan observed, looking up from his tactical picture.
Timothy, fair means I bring all my people home alive.
Fuck the others, Clark responded.
You say so, boss, the FBI agent agreed.
Together he and Clark watched the blips move toward the ones labeled L and P. 5 minutes after that, both of the unidentified blips dropped off the screen and did not return.
That's 2 more kills for our guys, John.
Jesus, this thing's magic, Clark said after Pierce and Loisel called in to confirm what the instrument had already told them.
Chavez to command.
Okay, Ding, go, Clark responded.
Can we use that instrument to move in on them?
I think so.
Tim, can we steer our guys in behind them, like?
Sure. I can see where everybody is, just a question of keeping them well clear until we bend them around and bring them in close.
Domingo, Noonan says he can do this, but it'll take time to do it right, and you guys'll have to use your heads.
I'll do the best I can, Jefe, Chavez called back.
It was 20 minutes before Henriksen tried to raise Dawson and Berg, only to find that they were not answering. There was something bad happening out there, but he didn't have a clue. Dawson was a former soldier, and Kilgore an experienced and skilled hunter. And yet they'd fallen off the earth without a trace? What was happening here? There were soldiers out there, yes, but nobody was that good. He had little choice but to leave his people out there. Patterson moved first, along with Scotty McTyler, heading west-northwest for 300 meters, then turning south, moving slowly and silently, blessing the surprisingly bare ground in the forest. The ground got little sunlight to allow grass to grow here. Steve Lincoln and George Tomlinson also moved as a team, steering around 2 bad guy blips to their north and maneuvering right behind them.
We have our targets, McTyler reported in his Scottish burr. On Noonan's screen they appeared to be less than 100 meters away, directly behind them.
Take 'em down, Clark ordered.
Both men were facing east, away from the rainbow troopers, one sheltering behind a tree and the other lying on the ground. The standing one was Mark Waterhouse. Patterson took careful aim and loosed his 3-round burst. The impacts pushed him against the tree, and he dropped his rifle, which clattered to the ground. That caused the lying one to turn, and grip his own rifle tighter when he was hit, and the reflexive action of his hand held the trigger down, resulting in 10 rounds fired on full automatic into the forest.
Oh, shit, Patterson said over the radio. That was mine. His rifle must have been set on rock and roll, command.
What was that? What was that? Who fired? Henriksen called over the radio. It only made things easier for Tomlinson and Lincoln. Both of their targets jumped up and looked to their left, bringing both into plain view. Both went down an instant later. And a few minutes after that, the command voice on the enemy radio circuit called for another status check. It now came up 8 names short. By this time, Rainbow was more behind than in front of Henriksen's people, steered into place by Noonan's computer tricorder rig.
"Can you get me on their radio?" Clark asked the FBI agent.
"Easy," Noonan replied, flipping a switch and plugging a microphone in.
Here.
Hi there, Clark said over the CB frequency. That's 8 of your people down.
Who is this?
Is your name Henriksen? John asked next.
Who the hell is this? The voice demanded.
I'm the guy who's killing your people. We've taken 8 of them down. Looks like you have 22 more out here. Want I should kill some more?
Who the fuck are you?
The name's Clark. John Clark. Who are you?
William Henriksen, the voice shouted back.
Oh, okay. You're the former bureau guy. I suppose you saw Will Gehring this morning. Anyway, Clark paused. I'm only going to say this once. Put your weapons down, walk into the open, and surrender. And we won't shoot any more of you. Otherwise, we'll take down every single one, Bill. There was a long silence. Clark wondered what the voice on the other end would do. But after a minute, he did what John expected.
Listen up, everybody. Listen up. Pull back to the building right now. Everybody move back right now.
Rainbow, this is 6. Expect movement back to the building complex right now. Weapons are free, he added over the encrypted tactical radios. The panic in Henriksen's radio call turned out to be contagious. Immediately they heard the thrashing sound of people running in the woods, through bushes, taking direct, if not quiet, paths back toward the open to which many ran without thinking. That made an easy shot for Homer Johnston. One green-clad man broke from the trees and ran down the grassy part next to the runway. The weapon he carried made him an enemy, and Johnston dispatched a single round that went between his shoulder blades. The man took one more stumbling step and went down.
Rifle 2-1. I got one north of the runway, the sniper called in.
It was more direct for Chavez. Ding was sheltering behind a hardwood tree when he heard the noises coming his way from 2 people he'd been stalking alone. When he figured they were about 50 meters away, he stepped around the tree trunk to see that they were heading the other way. Chavez sidestepped left and spotted one, and brought his MP-10 to his shoulder. The running man saw him and tried to bring up his rifle. He even managed to fire, but right into the ground, before taking a burst in the face and falling like a sack of beans. The man behind him skidded to a stop and looked at where Chavez was standing.
"Drop the fucking rifle!" Ding screamed at him.
But the man either didn't hear or didn't listen. His rifle started coming up too, but as with his companion, he never made it.
"Chavez here, I just dropped 2.
The excitement of the moment masked the shame of how easy it had been. This was pure murder. It was like keeping score for Clark, like some sort of horrid gladiatorial game. The unknown blips on the screen of Noonan's computer started disappearing as their hearts stopped, and with them the electronic signals they generated. In another few minutes he counted 4 of the 30 signals they'd originally tracked, and those were running back to the building.
"Christ, Bill, what happened out there?" Breitling demanded at the main entrance.
"They slaughtered us like fucking sheep, man. I don't know. "This is John Clark calling for William Henriksen," the radio crackled.
"Yeah?"
"Okay, one last time. Surrender right now, or else we come in after you."
"Come and fucking get us!" Henriksen screamed in reply.
"Vega, start doing some windows," Clark ordered in a calm voice.
"Roger that command," Oso replied.
He lifted the shoulder stock of his M60 machine gun and started on the second floor. The weapon traced right to left, shattering glass as the line of tracers darted across the intervening distance into the building. "Pierce and Loisel, you and Connolly head northwest into the other buildings. Start taking stuff down."
"Roger, command," Pierce replied.
The survivors from the forest party were trying to shoot back, mainly at empty air, but making noise in the lobby of the headquarters building.
Carol Breitling was screaming now. The glass from the upstairs windows cascaded like a waterfall in front of their faces.
"Make them stop!"
Carol cried loudly. "Give me the radio," Breitling said. Henriksen handed it to him. "Cease firing. This is John Breitling. Cease firing, everybody. That means you too, Clark, okay?" In a few seconds it stopped, which proved harder for the project people, since Rainbow had only one weapon firing, and Oso stopped immediately on being ordered to. "Breitling, this is Clark. Can you hear me?" The radio in John's hand crackled next. "Yes, Clark, I hear you. Bring all of your people into the open right now and unarmed," the strange voice commanded. "And nobody will get shot. Bring all of your people out now, or we start playing really rough."
"Don't do it," Bill Henriksen urged,
seeing the futility of resistance, but fearing surrender more and preferring to die with a weapon in his hands.
"So they can kill us all right here and right now?" Carol asked. "What choice do we have?"
"Not much of one," her husband observed. He walked to the reception desk and made a call over the building's intercom system, calling everyone to the lobby. Then he lifted the portable radio. "Okay, okay, we'll be coming out in a second. Give us a chance to get organized." "Okay, we'll wait a little while," Clark responded.
"This is a mistake, John," Henriksen told his employer.
"This whole fucking thing's been a mistake, Bill," John observed, wondering where he'd gone wrong. As he watched, the black helicopter reappeared and landed about halfway down the runway, as close as the pilot was willing to come to hostile weapons. Paddy Connolly was at the fuel dump. There was a huge above-ground fuel tank labeled Number 2 Diesel, probably for the generator plant. There was nothing easier, or more fun, to blow up than a fuel tank. And with Pierce and Loiselle watching, the explosives expert set 10 pounds of charges on the opposite side of the tank from the generator plant that it served. A good 80,000 gallons, he thought. Enough to keep those generators going for a very long time.
"Command, Connolly."
"Connolly, command," Clark answered. "I'm going to need more, everything I brought down," he reported. "It's on the chopper, Paddy. Stand by."
"Roger."
John had advanced to the edge of the tree line, a scant 300 yards from the building. Just beyond him, Vega was still on his heavy machine gun, and the rest of his troops were close by, except for Connolly and the 2 shooters with him. The elation was already gone. It had been a grim day. Success or not, there is little joy in the taking of life, and this day's work had been as close to pure murder as anything the men had ever experienced.
"Coming out," Chavez said, his binoculars to his eyes. He did a fast count.
"I see 26 of them."
"About right," Clark said.
"Gimme," he said next, taking the glasses from Domingo to see if he could recognize any faces. Surprisingly, the first face he could put a name on was the only woman he saw, Carol Breitling, presidential science advisor. The man next to her would be her former husband, John Breitling, Clark surmised. They walked out, away from the building, onto the ramp that aircraft used to turn around on. "Keep coming straight out away from the building," he told them over the radio. And they did what he told them, John saw, somewhat to his surprise.
"Okay, Ding, take a team and check the building out. Move, boy, but be careful."
"You bet, Mr. C."
Chavez waved for his people to follow him at a run for the building. Using the binoculars again, Clark could see no one carrying weapons, and decided that it was safe for him to walk out with 5 Team 1 troops as an escort. The walk took 5 minutes or so, and then he saw John Breitling face to face.
"I guess this is your place, eh?"
"Until you destroyed it."
The guys at Fort Detrick checked out the canister that Mr. Gearing there tried to use in Sydney, Dr. Breitling. If you're looking for sympathy from me, pal, you've called the wrong number. So, what are you going to do? Just as he finished the question, the helicopter lifted off and headed for the power plant building, delivering the rest of Connolly's explosives, Clark figured. I've thought about that.
You killed our people!
Carol Breitling snarled, as though it meant something. The ones who were carrying weapons in a combat zone, yeah. And I imagine they would have shot at my people if they'd had a chance. But we don't give freebies.
Those were good people. People
who were willing to kill their fellow man. And for what? John asked.
To save the world,
Carol Breitling snapped back. You say so, ma'am. But you came up with a horrible way to do it, don't you think? He asked politely. It didn't hurt to be polite, John thought. Maybe it would get them to talk. And maybe then he could figure them out.
I wouldn't expect you to understand.
I guess I'm not smart enough to get it, eh?
No, she said, you're not.
Okay, but let me get this right. You were willing to kill nearly every person on Earth, to use germ warfare to do it, so that you could hug some trees?
So that we could save the world, John Breitling repeated for them all.
Okay, Clark shrugged. I suppose Hitler thought killing all the Jews made sense. You people sit down and keep still. He walked away and got onto his radio. There was no understanding them, was there? Connolly was fast, but not a miracle worker. The generator room he left alone. As it turned out, the hardest thing to take care of was the freezer in the main building. For this he borrowed a Hummer. There were a bunch of them here, and used it to ferry two oil drums into the building. There being no time for niceties, Connolly simply drove the vehicle through the glass walls. Meanwhile, Malloy and his helicopter ferried half the team back to Manaus and refueled before returning. All in all, it took nearly 3 hours, during which time the prisoners said virtually nothing. Didn't even ask for water, hot and uncomfortable as it was on the frying pan surface of the runway. Clark didn't mind. It was all the better if he didn't have to acknowledge their humanity. Strangest of all to him, these were educated people, people whom he could easily have respected. Except for that one little thing. Finally, Connolly came striding over to where he was standing, holding an electronic box in his hand. Clark nodded and cued his tactical radio. Bear command.
Bear copies.
Let's get wound up, Colonel. Roger that. Bear's on the way. In the distance, the Nighthawk's rotor started turning, and Clark walked back to where the prisoners were sitting. "We are not going to kill you, and we are not going to take you back to America," he told them. The surprise in their faces was stunning.
"What then?"
"You think we should all live in harmony with nature, right?"
"If you want the planet to survive, yes," John Breitling said.
His wife's eyes were filled with hatred and defiance, but also curiosity now. "Fine," Clark nodded. "Stand up and get undressed, all of you. Dump your clothes right here." He pointed at a corner joint in the runway.
"But..."
"Do it!" Clark shouted at them. "Or I will have you shot right here and right now." And slowly they did. Some disrobed quickly, some slowly and uncomfortably. But one by one they piled their clothing up in the middle of the runway. Carol Breitling, oddly, wasn't the least bit modest about the moment.
"Now what?"
she asked. "Okay, here's the score. You want to live in harmony with nature? Then go do it. If you can't hack it, the nearest city is Manaus. About 98 miles that way." He pointed, then turned.
Paddy, fire in the hole. Without a word, Connolly started flipping switches on his box. The first thing to go was the fuel tank. The twin charges blew a pair of holes in the side of the tank. That ignited the diesel fuel, which blew out of the tank like the exhaust from a rocket, and propelled the tank straight into the powerhouse, less than 50 meters away. There the tank stopped and ruptured, pouring burning number 2 diesel fuel over the area. They couldn't see the freezer area in the main building go, but here as well the diesel fuel ignited, ripping out the wall of the freezer unit and then dropping part of the building on the burning wreckage. The other buildings went in turn, along with the satellite dishes. The headquarters residence building went last, its poured concrete core resisting the damage done by the cratering charges. But after a few seconds of indecision, the core snapped at the ground floor level and collapsed, bringing the rest of the building down with it. Over a period of less than a minute, everything useful to life here had been destroyed. "You're sending us out into the jungle without even a knife?" Henriksen demanded.
"Find some flint rocks and make one," Clark suggested, as the Nighthawk landed.
"We humans learned how to do that about 500,000 years ago."
"You want to be in harmony with nature? Go harmonize," he told them, as he turned to get aboard.
Seconds later, he was strapped into the jump seat behind the pilots, and Colonel Malloy lifted off without circling.
You could always tell, Clark remembered from his time in Third SOG.
There were those who got out of the Huey and ran into the bush, and there were those who lingered to watch the chopper leave. He'd always been one of the former, because he knew where the job was. Others only worried about getting back, and didn't want the chopper to leave them behind. Looking down one last time, he saw that all the eyes down there were following the Nighthawk as it headed east.
"Maybe a week, Mr. C?" Ding asked, reading his face.
A graduate of the U.S. Army's Ranger School, he didn't think that he could survive very long in this place.
"If they're lucky," Rainbow Six replied.
Epilogue. News. The International Trib landed on Chavez's desk after the usual morning exercise routine, and he leaned back comfortably to read it. Life had become boring at Hereford. They still trained and practiced all their skills, but they hadn't been called away from the base since returning from South America 6 months earlier. "Gold Mine in the Rockies," a front-page story started. A place in Montana, the article read, owned by a Russian national, had been found to contain a sizable gold deposit. The place had been bought as a ranch by Dmitry A. Popov, a Russian entrepreneur, as an investment and vacation site, and then he'd made the accidental discovery, the story read. Mining operations would begin in the coming months. Local environmentalists had objected and tried to block the development in court, but the federal district court judge had decided in summary judgment that laws from the 1800s governing mineral exploration and exploitation were the governing legal authority, and tossed the objections out of court.
"You see this?" Ding asked Clark.
"Greedy bastard," John replied, checking out the latest pictures of his grandson on Chavez's desk.
"Yeah, I read it. He spent $500,000 to buy the place from the estate of Foster Honeycutt. I guess the bastard told him more than just what Breitling was planning, eh?"
"I suppose."
Chavez read on. In the business section, he learned that Horizon Corporation stock was heading back up with the release of a new drug for heart disease, recovering from the loss in value that had resulted from the disappearance of its chairman, Dr. John Breitling, several months earlier. A mystery that remained to be solved, the business reporter added. The new drug, Cardiclear, had proven to reduce second heart attacks by fully 56% in FDA studies. Horizon was also working on human longevity and cancer medications, the article concluded.
John, has anybody gone back to Brazil to...
Not that I know of.
Satellite overhead show that nobody's cutting the grass next to their airport.
So, you figure the jungle killed them?
Nature isn't real sentimental, Domingo. She doesn't distinguish between friends and enemies.
I suppose not, Mr. C.
Even terrorists could do that, Chavez thought, but not the jungle. So, who was the real enemy of mankind?
Himself, mostly, Ding decided, setting the newspaper down and looking again at the photo of John Connor Chavez, who'd just learned to sit up and smile. His son would grow into the brave new world, and his father would be one of those who tried to ensure that it would be a safe one, for him and all the other kids whose main tasks were learning to walk and talk.
This concludes the reading of Rainbow Six by Tom Clancy. This book was read by Michael Pritchard.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.